This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's TV Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews with the stars and creators of classic and current TV shows. Today, crime shows. Peter Falk is known to TV viewers around the world as Columbo, the disheveled and seemingly inept detective who always managed to solve the crime. Falk has portrayed Columbo on and off since 1971. He's also highly regarded for his work with director John Cassavetes in such films as Husbands and A Woman Under the Influence. He won a Tony Award for his performance in Neil Simon's Prisoner of Second Avenue. I spoke with Peter Falk about Columbo in 1995. What was the part of Columbo like when you first read it?
It was very good. It was somebody that I immediately wanted to play. But the basic thrust of a guy appearing less than he actually is, that was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And that disarming quality of not ever appearing formidable was always there. I think that when we started to make the series, they would often write scenes that were supposed to be humorous. And those are the ones that made me very, very nervous.
Why?
Because I didn't think they were funny. They were kind of cute. And so I would tamper with those all the time to make sure that they were funny, that they were humorous, not funny, and that they were more subtle and more believable. And the other thing that I guess I insisted upon was that I think that he is by birth a polite man, but he's also canny, so he's not above using his politeness. But the fact that he is polite makes it easier for him to play polite. And the other thing that used to bother me about the early scripts, not the early scripts, any of the scripts, was in the final scene, if you had what actors used to refer to as Moisture the Explainer scenes. That's when the detective, he takes two pages, he talks for two pages and he explains everything that happened. And as the actor, you can hear the people snoring. You know the audience is tuned out. They're not interested. So the trick is to have that final scene remain a scene and have the cat and mouse going back and forth. And the audience plus the villain, they don't know what in the hell this guy's driving at, but they're interested. You show them just enough to keep them interested, keep them guessing what is he going to do. And when you finally nail the guy, that should be the end of the show. It should be about three lines after that, and that's it. It was things like that that used to... And clues. The clues can't be transparent. And if they're obvious to the audience, then he's not Sherlock Holmes.
I like the way you described Columbo as looking like less than he actually is. That's something that's easy to identify with. Did you identify with that?
I've always been sloppy all my life. I never could keep myself together. And I am in person a bit misty. I can't keep an umbrella more than 3 days. That was when I used to live in New York. You'd lose it and lose everything. And frequently walk in the walls. So I understood that quality. And I am a slow thinker. I am attracted to ambiguity. I'm not somebody that has black and white answers to everything. And that kind of fits in with Columbo. So the slowness and the methodicalness and the sloppiness, that was all very easy for me.
And, of course, I should ask you about the raincoat, Columbo's raincoat, which I believe you bought.
Mm. Well, there was a dispute over that because I...
What, over who really bought it?
No, the dispute was... I always said that I read that in the script, but Lincoln Levinson said, no, it wasn't in the script. But I seem to remember seeing it in the script, so whatever it is. I did buy it, but I didn't buy it at the time. I had already had it, but I said, this is what I want to wear. And I knew what I wanted to wear underneath it, too. I wanted everything to be tan and brown all together. A little dash of dull green in the tie. And that's about as flashy as he got. And the suit that fitted me the least was a seersucker, kind of seersucker blue and white. So I said, dye that. And they dyed it and got out all that white, whatever the hell it was, I don't remember, but it had to be dyed. And that became tan, and the shoes were mine, too. They were a pair of shoes I picked up in Italy, I don't know, a long time ago. They happened to be fairly expensive shoes, handmade shoes, but they were very comfortable, and they were clunky.
And that was important, clunky?
Clunky was important, yeah.
For that sense of being slightly uncoordinated?
I think he always wanted that contrast because the people that he was going after, they were always...
wealthy.
They were always, yes, God's chosen.
I mean,
they all had long necks and they all could buy suits off the rack and they fitted them and they looked good and... their teeth were white, and they had dough, and they spoke well, and so clunky shoes were a good contrast.
I have one more Columbo question for you. Do you think that your long association with that character has worked for you, against you, both in the other part of your career, the part outside of Columbo?
Well, I always say the same thing, Terry.
Say it again.
I'll say it again. Being known as Columbo, and it ain't cancer, so... I make a lot of dough, and the listeners, you know, I think it's difficult for the average person to say, what's he complaining about that he's typecast? Who the hell cares? I mean, he does make a lot of money, and he gets good seats in restaurants, and so I don't feel that that's something that people are really interested in, but... To answer your question, I think arguably I probably would be a better actor if I hadn't spent so much time playing that one role. I think that kind of diversity and that kind of challenge, I might be a better actor. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think probably I would be. But so what?
I want to ask you, you have a glass eye. And I think that happened when you were three. You had a tumor removed.
Yeah.
And I guess they removed your eye, too?
It was a malignant tumor.
Do you think that that's... that you've made that work for you as an actor to affect your image, to use it as something that looked menacing or that made you look more vulnerable?
Well, none of that was consciously... I mean, the only thing that I would be aware of when I was acting was a try to avoid looking 100% wall-eyed. I mean, so that if you were to look in one direction and one eye went all the way to the left and the other one was still in the middle, I try to avoid that. But I have never consciously felt that, though I'll use it in some way.
Geez, could you not get shot from certain angles because your eye wouldn't move and that would be the only eye on camera?
I'm better off from the left side. I think that minimizes the wall-eyed thing.
Mm-hmm. Did kids pay you to look? You know how kids are.
That would have been good. No, they never did that. Now, when you were a kid, you know, I used to dread that moment when somebody would say, "What's the matter with your eye?" or something like that. And there was a turning point, I don't know, when I was 12 or 13 years old. I think it had to do more with playing ball with the guys because once you started knocking around with those guys, they were so open about it and they would say it so freely and it was usually a gag or a joke or knocking you or whatever the hell it is that by then it didn't mean anything to me anymore. I was very comfortable with it.
Did it interfere with
it? Because I realized, yeah. The other thing is then I realized I could get a laugh with it.
No, did it interfere with anything that you wanted to do?
No. No, not at all. No, the main... Well, I think one of the main problems with the eye was the fact that my mother would, if I'd go play football or whatever sport, she was always nervous about it. And I always thought that was ridiculous. Nothing to be nervous about. You know, when you're that age, nothing can happen to you. You could always get people's attention if you took a spoon and tapped it.
Oh, gosh.
Well, the first night, I remember the first night I was in a Merchant Marine. There was this black guy from San Francisco. I think it was from Oakland. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. We just had shared this forecastle together for the first night. And he was sitting up in the top bunk opposite me. And I came in and I sat down. It was already very, very late. And he had his pajamas on. So I started getting undressed. At that time, I had my front teeth were knocked out. And I had a removable bridge. So I took out that bridge and put it on the table. It had a nice sound effect, a little clunk when that went down. And then I popped the eye out, and then the glass hit the tabletop. That had a nice sound effect. And he's up there. He's up there watching me. And then I bent over, and I started unscrewing my knee. It was a gesture, you know, where I started turning it. And it looked like I was about to remove my leg. And I always remember him saying, "Excuse me, I'll be right back." He went somewhere, probably to men's room.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, you're very welcome.
Peter Falk recorded in 1995. Coming up, J.K. Simmons, the neo-Nazi on the HBO prison series Oz. This is Fresh Air.